Good day, wherever you may be. Welcome to Observations. Scott Kirk and I, Craig, are here today. We're going to pick up where we left off a week ago. Actually, now, I guess a couple of weeks ago, where we were discussing, Kirk, the research you had done to find lots of independent corroboration for the 10 plagues of the Exodus. And then for the immediate aftermath of what transpired in Egypt, not only during the culmination of the Exodus, but immediately thereafter, and found just extraordinary written documents dating to the period which chronicle these events from the perspective of the Egyptians.
Yeah. And you know, the history of Egypt after they leave wouldn't mean anything to us as far as other than how does it play out with Israel, because there's some connections there that are amazing, and what happens there also affects Israel for a great number of years. So that would be the major reason.
Right. Yeah, I think that the Exodus story and the verification, independent verification of the 10 plagues through Egyptian literature is just, you know, we're pretty accustomed to finding extraordinary affirmations of Yahweh's testimony. And so, you know, on a 1 to 10 scale, these might be threes, but they are extraordinary. It's just that we're pretty spoiled with finding lots of things. And even a three is worth hours of investigation and presentation, because, you know, I was talking with someone today about conspiracy theories. And a conspiracy theory is very much like Muhammad's Quran and Paul's New Testament. You know, in the midst of the deceptions, there is a sprinkle here and there of the truth, which makes the conspiracy theory more more believable, more seductive. And you know, we were talking about how you know, people almost get a religious zeal for these things, very hard to pull away from them. And so, Yahweh's testimony is just so straightforward, but it just seems like when you talk about 10 plagues in Egypt, it seems so contrary to what we have been led to believe that you know, when you present it, unless somebody's going to give you a lot of time and you can say, here's the evidence to affirm this, you know, it sounds like you're presenting something really crazy.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to find affirmation after affirmation. And one of the things that was so gratifying to me is all the really detailed affirmations I found on regarding Noah, the Ark, and the flood, and specifically where and how it all occurred. And you've done the same thing with the Exodus. Now,
a little bit,
Now, after the Exodus, though, we actually come into a more relevant discussion, particularly for this program, which is Observations for Our Time. Because you're immediately dealing with a group of people that were actually quite well known to history. They're quite well known in the in Yahweh's testimony. They intersect the lives of several
the big players.
They intersect the lives of Moshe, Yahshua, King Shaul, Dode. I mean, there's an intersection there that is really compelling.
Yes, sir.
But for the two things that should strike me is that a lot of people reject the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, particularly the Torah, because they say the God of the Old Testament is, you know, mean and wrathful, and he wanted a bunch of people killed, and there's really no justification for that in a modern sensibilities. And when you get to know the Amalekites, you realize that the most merciful thing to do was to kill them. By far the most merciful thing. The only compassionate, rational thing that could be done with the Amalekites is to kill them.
Yeah.
And Yahweh made the right decision on behalf of his family and his home, Yisrael, to rid his home of their viciousness. And the other part of it is that there is no distinction, really, of any kind. Not in what part of the world they emerge, and not in their religion or in their militarism or in their attitude or their perversity, nor the places that they conquered and abused between the Amalekites and today's Muslims.
Yeah, no one regretted. No one else in the world regretted that they were removed.
No. No. You know,
the Egyptians certainly didn't. The Babylonians didn't. The Persians didn't.
No.
They were delighted these people went away.
Yeah. Now, I want to be really careful here because not only am I a nonviolent individual, and I want to make certain that nobody goes off and harms, much less kills anyone, based upon anything that we're saying. We were not called to do this, and anybody that does it is doing something that is a tremendous mistake.
Don't do it.
Right. Now, if you're having an open, public dialogue with Yahweh, and God is in your presence day and night, and he is speaking directly to you, and he says, I'm taking you into my home, but I want you to remove from my home this vicious, venomous animal. Then you do what he asks you to do in his home. Mm-hmm. It is his home, and he is God, after all. But there is absolutely no divine edict telling us to do it any place else or at any other time, for any reason whatsoever. So to go off and harm people because they manifest the same perverse characteristics as the Amalekites would be wrong. Now, today, you want to expose them and condemn them with your words.
Right.
And then the last...
We've already tried, the government already tried the other way. It hasn't done anything but create more harm.
Right. Yeah, the United States government is into this let's kill them mode, and in doing that is making a bad situation worse.
Yeah.
We're into expose them. Expose and condemn the religion that drives them to such viciousness and madness. And the second thing that I wanted to say, or the third thing really I wanted to say before we jump back into this, is that righteous indignation is a good thing. Hate, when properly directed, is a virtue. And in our society, we have people who are hating, viciously hating, aggressively hating, campaigning against hate. And it is very pervasive among young liberal people in America today. And they chant these hateful slogans with those hateful signs protesting hate, and it's just so despicable. But in fact, hate, when properly directed, is one of the most loving things you can possibly do. You know, we ought to hate terrorists and terrorism and what motivates people to be terrorists. We shouldn't accept them. We ought to hate slave traders and pedophiles, rapists. We ought not try to understand them. We ought not try to accommodate them. Yes, we ought to despise what they're doing and have no reluctance whatsoever to state that.
Yeah.
Now, that being the case, Yahweh is quite open and blunt when it comes to showing his disdain. That's a soft word for hate, for the people known as the Amalekites, which you have demonstrated came from the same areas of Western Arabia that the first Muslims came from. And they had exactly the same effect, conquering the same areas initially,
conquering is almost too strong a word. You know, they invaded what had been destroyed, and they really attacked helpless people for the most part. There was no army to protect them, and they just destroyed them, raped them. You know, this is conquering is just
that suggests they were like disciplined, like the Romans or the Greeks or the Carthaginians. They were not.
No, we're going to take every one of their tactics here in a minute, too. So.
But it's also important to recognize that what's considered to be the golden era of Islam was not of conquering either. You see, the Persians and the Romans, the Byzantines and the surrounding, everything from Visigoths to Gauls to Vandals, they had bludgeoned themselves to the point where there really wasn't, there wasn't an intact, effective kingdom and military anywhere in the world at the time that Islam emerged.
Mm-hmm. They just filled the void.
Right. So what they did is they were marauders filling the void. It's kind of like the time of Genghis Khan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he and his marauders and his son, Kublai Khan, were able to, they didn't conquer places. They didn't build an empire. They didn't create a legacy of anything, just like the Muslims didn't. They were just very good at playing, robber barons. You know, they raped, they plundered, they invaded, they murdered, they tortured. They didn't build anything. And you look at the history of Islam since that time, it hasn't contributed anything to the world. It's just been this just blanket of violence and hatred and of deceit. So the Amalekites were very much like today's Muslims, and the Muslims for a better part of 1,400 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, just real quick before we begin, I found it almost amazingly funny that for a country like Saudi Arabia that lived off of oil since the late 30s.
Yeah, since it was established as a fiefdom.
And they have all their universities, and they send all the people to Harvard or wherever they send them. And they ask them, you know, and when it came to building a refinery, they had to get the Chinese to build it.
Or the Americans, or the British.
Or the Americans.
Yeah,
but
the British.
Last one they did. They I think they went to.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Are you crazy?
Correct.
This is your business.
Right. Well, they don't work. It's a welfare state. The Saudi Arabians themselves don't work. The Kuwaitis don't work. In fact, in each of these countries, the people don't work. They receive a subsidy from the dictator, whoever the king is, the emirate. They receive a subsidy, that'll work. And they hire, it's not just that they hire foreign workers, they abuse them. I mean, this story of particularly women coming from places like Nepal that are brought into places, they're being told they're going to be brought into something like the Dubai or something like that. Well, they never get to Dubai. You know, their flights are always go into something like Kuwait, and then when they end in Kuwait, they go across the border into Saudi Arabia. And in those countries, not only is slavery still allowed, but you have the vicious mindset of the Muslim. And these women have their passports taken, even though these people are filthy rich, they don't pay their now slaves anything. And in a country like Saudi Arabia, which is disgusting that America would even go there, you know, that Trump saying that he's going to go to Saudi Arabia and going to meet with the Muslim world while he also goes to the Vatican and Israel because he wants to unite the three religions against terrorism. What a buffoon. But to even go to Saudi Arabia when the Saud royal family has tens of thousands of slaves, which they torture every day. And if a woman escapes the home, she's rounded up, sent back to the home where she is tortured and sometimes killed.
Yeah.
And that even the U.S. embassy, see, if you were a slave and you somehow managed as a woman, which you can't go anywhere as a woman in Saudi Arabia by yourself. But let's say that you as a slave got out and you were able to somehow get a ride to the U.S. embassy. The U.S. embassy would turn you back over to the Sauds and they would put you in prison. And then you would be subjected to go back to the place that enslaved you, no matter how many wounds you had on your body to show that you were abused.
That's disgusting.
And yet the United States, you know, Trump is going there to do business with them, to have talks with them about ending terrorism. It's just despicable. And there is something as bad as abusing slaves. And that's aiding and abetting those countries that do so.
Yeah.
And that's where we find the United States.
Well, that's the parallel to what we're reading about right now with Egypt. So.
It sure is. So you turn to Judges, which would be Shaphat in Hebrew. And by the way, the Judges were not... Judges is really not a great translation of Shaphat. And you're going to turn to Shaphat 6, 3 through 6.
3 through 6.
Yeah. The reason is that the term Shaphat means to decide, to distinguish between right and wrong, between true and false. And the Shaphat, their role was, if disputes arose among the people, or questions arose among the people, either disputes or questions, it was their job to use the Torah as the basis of resolving those questions or disputes. So they were good listeners who were extremely well-versed on the Torah, who helped the people reason their way through questions to find answers and disputes.
Right.
It's a far more accurate depiction of who the Shaphat were and what they represented. And, of course, in the Torah, the single most important word, which is a compound word that includes Shaphat, is Mishpat.
Mishpat, yeah.
And the Mishpat are the terms and conditions that comprise the covenant relationship. And God encourages us with the term Mishpat to exercise good judgment regarding them.
Yes, sir.
All right, so Shaphat 6, 3 through 6.
Yes, sir. And it was so, and so it was, when Israel had sown, had planted their seed, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites with them, and the children of the east, and they encamped against them, and it destroyed the increase of the earth, until they came into Gaza, and left no substance for the Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass. For they came up with their cattle in their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for a multitude. For both they and the camels were without number, and they entered into the land, and they destroyed it. And Israel, or Yisrael, was greatly impoverished.
Wow. Now, if you think about that from the perspective of Islam's creation with Muhammad, right, they were camel drivers, caravanners. Muhammad himself didn't work.
No.
He was out being religious, which means he was being following the pagan religious rites of the Yemenites. It's interesting that the Yemenite Hanif poetry that comprises basically most of the first 20-ish surahs of the Quran when rendered chronologically was all really a derivative of the legacy of the Hebrews. They went there. They had a writing system. That's why Ar-Rahman was the name of God, because they wouldn't say Yahweh's name, and Ar-Rahman means merciful. And so it's a Hebrew name, and there's so many Hebrew characteristics to the Hanifs. But Muhammad then, because he didn't work, and he was, as were the Amalekites, covetous of every other people's productivity.
Yeah.
Muhammad's first act of the Islamic era was a raid against a caravan from his hometown. And he went there with armed men and performed an act of armed robbery. Yeah, it was straight old armed robbery. The Quran even says in the 8th surah that it was armed robbery.
Yeah, and then Muhammad's, like, you have to hide it. The Quran has it all.
Oh, yeah, it's all detailed in the Quran. 8th surah, it says, Muhammad wanted the booty. And so he went there, and it was an act of armed robbery. And that's how Islam began. That's what the Amalekites were all about. That's what the first Muslims, during the first 100 years following Muhammad's death, and during the 12 years that Muhammad lived in Medina, yesteryear's Yathrib, he led 75 of these raids. And we're wont to call them terrorist raids. But they really weren't. They were. Their primary purpose was Genghis Khan, without the sophistication. It was just an ongoing swath of armed robberies.
Yeah. Well, this is a very telling thing, and we'll find out why in a second, because this is actually a war tactic that they used. And if you think about it, we'll talk about that hopefully in a second. But my comment was they were called king shepherds, these people, mm-hmm. with the cattle and the camels without number.
Mm-hmm.
They would drive the cattle before them to devour the harvest,
right,
and take or steal away the oxen used for plowing and every other animal that someone would own, in this case the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
In Judges 7:12, or Shaphat, they and their cattle compared to grasshoppers and to the sand by the seaside. So we're talking a huge number. And they did the same thing in Egypt. We have that record by there's a Papyrus from the Hermitage, and it's a number, if somebody wants to look it up, is 116B. Recto just means on the front of that papyrus. It says that the Amu approached in their might and their hearts, raised against those who were gathered in the harvest, and they took away their kine or their ability to plow, and the land is utterly perished and naught remains. That's from Gardner's translations. In essence, what they did, and I tried to picture myself here, it's not a military onslaught like you think of the Romans or Alexander the Great or something like that. But if you're a farmer out there and you're used to using a plow, and then all of a sudden you have, let's just say, 3,000 cattle, and they flood your field. This is your food. This is everything you're going to live on for the next year and hopefully survive with. And these cows come flying down, and I grew up with horses and tried to round up cows and stuff. In case, Lynn, I'm going to tell you, thousands and thousands of them on the charge is something else. You get out of the way because they will trample everything, including you.
All right. Yeah, it reminds me of...
You're trying to save your field, and you're trying to stop these cows and everything, and then comes the next wave of the soldiers or the killers, and they have weapons, and you're an easy mark.
Oh, of course.
They just wipe out everything. Anything they don't take, the kill.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Muhammad when he signed the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, where he committed that he wouldn't terrorize and murder the Meccans for 10 years. And he went back and reneged on that the following year. But his bloodthirsty barbarians, covetous men that had ganged up with him, were going to Mecca to take a plunder. That's the only reason they were there. So, what happened is that Muhammad staged a siege of Kabar to satiate their cravings, and the township of Kabar came out with their plows and their hoes and their rakes to do agricultural work.
Yeah,
and they were slaughtered.
Yeah, they're no match.
And, yeah, no match.
If they come on horses and camels and stuff, you have a very difficult time trying to fight these people. They have the advantage on you. So in any case, that was really interesting. That's another indication, because what we were trying to build at the time was, through this section of the research, was that they were indeed these people, and they stayed around a long time. So we've encountered them in Egypt. We've encountered them, records in Egypt, as well as several in Israel.
Right.
So now let me move down just a tiny bit here. The king Apophis II, which is August II, also in some literature, sent a message from Avaris, El Arish, with a humiliating command to the Egyptian prince Sekinri. And the reason I added this into the information was because I was trying to see the structure of how the Amalekites were ruling Egypt. They were using it with puppet rulers. The Egyptians were princes from the various house or whatever, or the more upper class were actually being their governors, like much like Jeroboam was later in Israel in the northern kingdom. And we had some information here from Siliar Papyrus number 1. And it says that the prince of the southern city in Thebes remained silent, and he wept a long time, and he did not know how to return the answer to the messenger of King Apophis. The prince was arrested by a messenger and brought to Avaris, and the rest of the scroll is damaged. And what they're talking about here is that the Amalekites had a big fort, and it was at Avaris, which is also known as El Arish. And we keep that in the back of our mind, because that's going to come into play in just a few minutes when we start talking about Shaul a little bit later down the road. So what it established for me was that the princes of Egypt were governorships ruling the people under the commands of the Amalekites, and they ran everything out of Avaris. So everyone paid tribute to them, everyone did what they said, and that was the chain of command. This prince was terrified. If you go into El Arish, into that fortress, which had hundreds of thousands of troops that protected the border to the north, all the way to Syria, and protected everything from Memphis to Thebes, then that was the death hole.
Yeah, it's interesting, of course, that the name of the king, the Amalekite king, is Apophis, which is the name of the asteroid.
Yes.
That is scheduled to come within, well, about a quarter of the distance from the Earth to the Moon of before it is nudged en route. But Apophis, MN 2004, on April 13th, a Friday, in 2029, the midpoint of the tribulation.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you read this, that this is Apophis, and that it is, it's based upon the name for death and destruction, darkness, yes. Death and destruction, and you have these Amalekite having a king,
Pharaoh, yeah.
Yeah, named, and now a Pharaoh.
The first one and the last one, at least, were used.
Right. Apophis. It's really extraordinary, particularly when you consider the fact that in 2029, we're going to be in the midst between the two Magog wars, which are both Islamic wars against Israel. You know, the first is just all the Muslim nations uniting after the fall of Damascus in Syria, then attacking Israel. And the second phase of it's where the whole world takes sides on one side of another of on Islam. And the world is plunged into a nuclear darkness. And then we have the asteroid strike, but all under that name.
Mm-hmm. So now we have come kind of towards the end of the reign of the Amalekites, which covered about 400 years. And so let's carry on a little bit. There is a tremendous amount of evidence that the major outpost of the Amu was at El Arish. I have gone over everything, including David Rowe's book that I just got recently. And, of course, he agrees with this as well, and he has even more modern stuff that they found the city and so forth. And the old evidence that the archaeologists found up until about 1950, that they had a minimum of 250,000 troops there and probably another 500,000 people that supported and trained and fed and served these people. And it was considered quite a vicious place with the burial grounds and excavations with arms cut off and heads and animals. And it was just a mess.
Yeah, the Quran, you know, smite them on their necks, which means cut off their heads, and then cut off arms and legs on opposite sides. Quran 533, so 532. So we were reading about the same tactic.
Yeah, they always doing the same way. Just vicious people.
Mm-hmm.
So now that we have a parallel here in Samuel, when he's talking to Shaul or Saul, this is 15:2-3 on 1 Samuel, and thus said Yahweh. I remember that which Amalekite did. Did the to Israel, how we laid wait for him in the way when he came out from Egypt. And now go and smite the Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have. Shaul or Saul gathered 200,000 footmen plus 10,000 men of Yehuda. 1 Samuel 15:5, and Saul came to the city of Amalek, and he laid wait in the bed of a stream called Nakal. This would be the wadi of El Arish. I did a little research on that, and by George, there is a creek, and it dries up every summer. And so we've got to find a town that has enough troops, enough fear, that Saul would have to take over 200,000 troops to challenge him. I can't find one in history anywhere else, by the way. And
other than El Arish.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be a place that's near on the border between Israel and Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to be a place that has a dry creek bed for them to land and hide in that before they attacked them.
And it has to be a place that was easy pickings because it was the epicenter of the plagues of the Exodus.
That's right.
All of which fit.
So, if you can find another one, I'm game. I'll listen.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a closed-minded shop here. So we found out it was a dry riverbank there, and all these things fit completely. And in Samuel, so now let's go to 1 Samuel 15:7-8. And Saul smote the Amalekite for Havilah until thou comest to Sur, and that is next to Egypt. And he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. Now, what did Yahweh tell him to do?
He told him to wipe them. Yeah, wipe them out to the last.
And what does this jerk do? He didn't save the women and the children.
No.
He saved the dadgum king.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, he lets him go.
Yeah. Reminds me of what I just read. You know, the United States government has this extraordinary elaborate plan now that while the rest of the nation dies from an atomic holocaust, they have an entire air force and military arm that is designed just to save the president and his cabinet.
Yes.
It's the same thing here.
I hope I paid for that.
Oh, yeah, you did.
You did.
You did. Yeah.
If you'd hurry up and get a raise, we could pay some more.
Yeah, that was the issue with Shaul.
Yeah.
Whatever Yahweh told him to do, he did the opposite. You know, he would start off okay. You know, he went there.
Yeah.
And then he was just too big.
He laid siege. He destroyed. He won the battle.
Mm-hmm.
And then he let all the good, all the bad guys go. I mean,
yep. So there you have it. And of
now,
course,
there's a little side note here. According to James Breasted, who is the ancient records of Egypt, he's the one that translated the Saliar papyrus, and it records that the same events instead of Pharaoh or an Egyptian prince wins the battle, there is the one or a what they call a foreign liberator frees Egypt. And, of course, that would be Saul.
Yeah.
There was nobody from Egypt. Remember, these were vassals, and the reason we went through the thing on the just previously is to establish that they were governors, they were Egyptian people, and that's where we're going to find Amu, the first pharaoh of Egyptian heritage that replaces these guys. So that was what was going on. They were not the ones that conquered him. So there's no record anywhere that the Egyptians did this in Avaris. They couldn't conquer him. So
no.
Before attacking El-Arish, we go back to Saul here. Before attacking El-Arish, Saul made an agreement with the Kenites, which are affiliates of the Amalekites, and they were allowed to escape while under siege. In Samuel 15:6, and Saul said to the Kenites, "Go depart, get you down from the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them." So that the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. Now, there's only rumor here that they went one of two places. They either went back to Arabia, or they went to Palestine, or the southern part of where the
Philistia. Yeah, Philistia. There's no Palestine, but Philistia.
I know.
Yeah. The five towns of the Gaza area.
Yes. And apparently that's where they went because there was one more event that we just found in the Torah. And
so, of course, just go ahead and make your next enemy, right?
Yeah. Why not?
Sounds like America.
Again,
yeah.
Again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, let's let all the Nazis go and set up camp somewhere else.
Yeah, that's right.
And they did.
Let's go empower the Al Qaeda and the Taliban, a decade later we can go to war with them.
What was the congressman Charlie's war?
Yeah, Charlie. Yeah,
need help.
Charlie Wilson's war.
There you go. Charlie Wilson's war. Also, Dode, during the reign of Saul, he wasn't king just yet. He pursued the Amalekites and destroyed Ziklag, and you'll find that in the 1 Samuel 31-3. And he found an Egyptian. Now, this is an interesting little story because this just proves there again, and that he found an Egyptian that was serving his master, who was an Amalekite.
Yeah, there you go.
Found some trying to save some Israelite women and children. Dode rescued the women and the children, but once again, it showed that the Amalekites ruled over the Egyptian because you wouldn't have it any other way. It couldn't work that way, and it's all recorded there as well. And it also shows us that the Amu or the Amalekites invaded the south of Palestine or Philistia.
Mm-hmm.
So we know we're pretty well assured now that that's where they went. They certainly did not go back to Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
Because Samuel, you know, he kills, Samuel has to kill Agag the second, or Apophis the second.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the last pharaoh, that was Amu rulers.
Mm-hmm.
Shaul falls in disfavor, of course, and then he's killed. You know, he falls on, does he fall on his sword? Yeah, I believe he does, and
his son is killed.
At the same time. So.
Right.
He's
too afraid that he's going to be that those who have have won the battle were going to torture him and parade him around. And they probably would have, but he does take the coward's way out and goes and kills himself, falls on his sword. He actually wanted his armor bearer to kill him. And
get him.
Yeah, and the armor bearer said, "Nah, I'm not going to do that. You're going to do this yourself."
Yeah, good for him. Obviously, he fell in disfavor. He was killed. And Dod, the next stage is we have Dod and we have find Joab. And then we have a guy named Amos who becomes King Amos the First. He was besieging Sherwin, or Sherin, forgive my pronunciations. And they pursued that town for about 3 years before they actually destroyed it. And that was kind of the last vestige, I believe, that I can find of the Amalekites of any consequence. So it's kind of dying at that point. Now something remarkable happens here in history,
except for the fact that their culture remained.
Mm-hmm.
And Yemen,
and
in Western Arabia, Qusay, it was the right. Qusay was the person given credit for founding the pagan religion that was practiced in Mecca. And every aspect, including the five pillars of Islam, that Qusay practiced in Mecca, were identical to what's practiced today in Islam, and they were very similar to the mindset of the Amalekites. So their culture continued. They were vicious and at each other's throats. And they created a religion that's the most vicious religion in the history of humankind.
Yeah. We were at the point where now we have two cultures that grew exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
We've got, now that they're free from the Amalekites, you have Egypt starts to take off. They start under Amos the First.
Right.
And then at the same time, we have Dod taking over Israel, becoming the shepherd king.
Yeah, it's very much like what happened when the Israelis were given the opportunity following the Holocaust to go back to Israel, and you now had this little tiny sliver of land,
salted land
that had been devastated and nobody wanted it because it was just awful, nothing going on under the Ottoman control, right? And so they return under all sorts of restrictions, and the entire Islamic world trying to murder them and constantly warring with them, and yet this little tiny sliver of land becomes a freed of Islam, if you will. Still, Islam exists there, but no longer controlled by Islam, and it flourishes. And all the rest of the Islamic world doesn't around it. All they've got around it is black ooze.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so we witnessed the same thing here recently.
So we're going to find that Israel takes over. We're going to find that Egypt takes off. Under Dod, and then, of course, under Solomon, where they hit their peak.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, though, we're also going to find out that Jeroboam, who before his, I'm just giving you a little quick outline before we go to the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
He has the misfortune of leaving before his father Solomon dies. He goes to Egypt, and the king, or the Pharaoh there, actually gives him his daughter as his wife, and he becomes a de facto ruler when he returns later. So we'll get to that story in just a second. But what I wanted to do real quickly is I wanted to give you what I think is the more correct timeline of these events. Now, the tragedy of this all is, talk about fake news and fake reporting, is that the university systems and the English and the French and so forth, the European archaeologists, have put all this together, and they have used Manetho a little bit, but they put this thing where it cannot possibly happen. Even David Rohl on the timeline I looked at in his book, he doesn't give it enough time. If David Rohl is right, then Yah's a liar because they didn't stay in Egypt for 400 years.
Mm-hmm.
And David Rohl is right. The Amalekites only lasted a few short period of time, and then there's some Indo-European people run into place, and that's absurd. So there's no real evidence of that. I don't care.
Indo-Europeans running Egypt, you're right.
Yeah.
Come on.
So, well, that's in his, it's in his timeline. That's on page 275, somewhere in that area there. So I looked at that and said,
yeah. Okay. You know, the man does have some interesting research.
Yeah, it's just, stuff, but, you know, just like we, most of this information that I started with came out of a atheist Jewish guy who was a doctor from Russia who moved to Europe and wound up in America.
Yeah, and at least
he knew that the Torah said this, and he was trying to reconcile the Torah from a practical standpoint as an atheist. How did this happen?
Yeah, of course, but they and with him, there are some interesting finds. Like he found these scrolls, which you have now, and you can find an independent translation.
Lying out there, why didn't anybody put it together?
But just like David Rohl, his much of what he wrote was untrue. So you really have to have a filter.
You do, and that's the only thing I did with this stuff is I've tried to be. Based on 10 years of studying since I started with your books and then learned how to... Listen, I can't translate word squat, but I can look up every word in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Figure out every lexicon and everything.
Yeah. And you look for the words, you get the meaning.
Yeah, so I can understand what's going on. It's hard to pull the wool over my eyes all the time. So, what we have on the timeline, first of all, you have to look at the... I'm just going to hit the high notes on here. We have a situation where we have history in 1549 BCE. We have Amos the First. Now, that's the problem. Just keep that in mind. Amos the First in 1549. Mm-hmm. Then we have down on the normal Egyptian timeline, from most any Egyptian history that you study in an American university, they're going to give you this, I would suspect. They certainly did for me. Hepsut and Thutmose II, his daughter was Hepsut, or Su, you don't always pronounce the T, which he would be, according to them, in 1479. And she had a brother, husband-brother, Thutmose III, who followed her at her death in 1458. And then you go down to the Amenhoteps and so forth. Now, if that's true, we got some real problems. Now, I'm gonna go over to our friend Bradley Greer. He started all this, so
okay.
So I'm gonna use his timeline a minute.
My high school buddy.
Yeah, your high school buddy.
Yep.
So he started this, and I added some things to his timeline. We've got, and we're all agreed that we've got, and David Rohl actually agrees on this part. We've got the about 1800 BCE. We've got the great grandson of Abraham, of course, is Joseph, and he goes into Egypt as a slave.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the next big high point for me is about 1450, give or take a few years.
And by the way, the 1800 in Joseph, one of the things about Joseph in Egypt is that David Rohl does a really good job of presenting the evidence for him being there and the solutions that he came up with Agrarian change that made it possible for them to survive the 7 years of famine and proof that there was 7 years of famine, even proof of where Yosef's home was and in his influence in building storehouses throughout Egypt. So that's not a myth. The story of Yosef is very well documented in Egyptian history.
Yeah. And you know, he has this timeline of some of these events pretty good from the time of about 1450, the Exodus, give or take, wherever you want to put it, within a few years.
Mm-hmm.
You've got 1400, of course, you have Yosha, known as Joshua, and he would have to be there because we've got 40 years of running around in the desert. Before he returns with the second generation and they actually take the promised land. So if those are true, and then we've got a pretty good fix on what occurs between 1053 through 933 BCE, because that's what we know to be true about King Shaul and Samuel, Samuel and Dod or David, and Joab.
Right,
and they are talking. And the interesting thing is Dod and Joab are working with Amos, who became Amos the First, to finish off the Amalekites. Now I'm gonna tell you a little something about the Queen of Sheba, because this is just cool. Now, here's the evidence. Now I'm gonna tell you who the Queen of Sheba is.
Okay.
And if it ain't so, then give it your best shot, because this satisfies everything on my count. Here's a little step-by-step. You've got Solomon has a port at the Gulf of Aqaba, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he made a shrine there, and he built a port there. That's where they entered, or where they crossed over during the when they wiped out the Pharaoh.
Yuriba Beach.
Mm-hmm. You've got Solomon gives or trades with some queen somewhere in his lifetime. This big famous queen comes and brings him shiploads of goods and spices.
Mm-hmm.
And he recorded all this. This is both in, if what's not in the Torah is in all the Hebrew records,
mm-hmm.
secular records. And then we have pictures and reliefs of her ships and loaded with botanical things and just about everything that she would have brought.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have all the legends of he has an affair with and so forth. But, I mean, when you think about it, I'm not sure who Solomon didn't have an affair with.
Correct.
But be that as it may. Now we've
they like the girls. Both of them like girls.
Yeah. Hatshepsut.
Mm-hmm.
Here's her record.
Mm-hmm.
She has a navy. Now, mm-hmm. she doesn't need a navy to go to the Mediterranean because nobody trades on their own ships in the navy, including Solomon.
The Mediterranean the Mediterranean is absolutely controlled by the Carthaginians.
Yeah, that's right. That's the ship.
They are the traders. They're the.
You don't mess with them. You just pay the thing and they ship this to me and get this
right.
To me.
They're referred to as Tarshish in the Torah prophets and Psalm Tarshish, and they are the traders. So nobody else could.
He didn't build a navy to go there, so she has two options. She can build a navy to go up to the Gulf of Aqaba, which is what she records, or she can have a navy that goes down and find some great rich king that she can trade all this stuff with down in Africa. I've got a feeling that she probably went to Israel, because everybody, according to the Torah, all the kings and everyone were trading or wanted to go to see Solomon because he was considered so wise and land.
Beyond that, as you went south in Africa, the same problem exists then as exists now. It's a jungle and the malaria, malaria and all that kind of stuff. And it's just you couldn't create a civilization in those kind of conditions. So there wasn't anybody to trade with if she went to South Africa.
It wasn't a great big event like this, but she records, and this is all recorded on her walls of her temples.
Mm-hmm.
She receives this huge amount of gifts. Now, I call it trade because she gave a ton of stuff to him. He gave a ton of stuff to her. She receives gifts of silver and gold and myrrh and frankincense.
Yeah.
And just things that we kind of know about where they come from.
Solomon claims that he got Solomon got what he claims to be Egyptian chariots and horses to drive those chariots.
Yeah, we have pictures too, by the way. What reliefs are still left of her stuff and her ships that are loaded with botanicals that she brought back, and things that she took of her loading the ships of them loading the ships to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So. And she went to this place, this town that she calls Kodesh.
Kodesh, set apart.
Yeah, set apart. I'll do this.
So Hatshepsut is Sheba.
Queen, yeah, if she ain't queen, if she owned, by the way, she goes to the land of Sheba, which is a little piece of land down in Arabia. So if she ain't... as they say down south, if she ain't Sheba, then grits ain't groceries.
So,
now, you understand what all of that does to... You have Amos cannot be in 1549. He has to be a contemporary of Dode.
Right.
So now he's back around 1,000.
Right.
Hatshepsut, instead of being in 1479, she is a contemporary, obviously, of Solomon. So now we're in the 900s BCE.
Yeah. Solomon, the 900s. So, Dode was, 968 was kind of the end of Dode's time. He laid the cornerstone for the temple and died shortly thereafter.
Yeah. So now she has a brother who is her husband, and he's a minor player. And then after she dies in 1458, then her brother husband Thutmose III rules, and he has this. He is the one that is recorded that Jeroboam went and married. He left before Solomon died, and he goes and lives in Egypt. And in doing so, he is given, the king gives him his wife's daughter, marries him off to join the union. Mm-hmm. And when Solomon dies, he goes back. Of course, that's the time when, you know, the Egyptians come up and they raid everything and they steal everything out of the temple. And then then we have a split kingdom, and Jeroboam is in charge as a vassal. Or a governor, mm-hmm. like Pontius Pilate, you know, he's running the northern kingdom.
Right.
So if that ain't so, I don't know how you can reconcile this, but I'm willing to bet that Yahweh's timeline is right, and I can't find anything that would make me think it wasn't right.
Yeah, certainly the whole picture fits together.
Yeah. Now, that's a lot of stuff, and I appreciate y'all bearing with me on all this stuff, but it brings up some questions, and I don't know.
So who do you think was the Pharaoh of the Exodus under that basis?
Well, you know, he said, David Rose said that it was Dumos.
Yes.
Dumos, and I haven't researched it enough to say, you know, he's almost not too important in the sense, but he's obviously not on this timeline, and he would have to be. There's no doubt in the middle of the 1400s the Exodus took place. It cannot be later, and here's why it can't be later. If it's later, you've got a real problem with Yosha when he goes and sees the walls of Jericho.
Yeah,
because they have carbon dating, and I had some research on that somewhere. They have some carbon dating on that where it had to fall. The last walls, the big walls, fell about the 1400s.
Okay.
That's about 40 years afterwards, or 45 years afterwards.
Well, that's perfect timing.
If he doesn't show up on that time, though, Craig,
right.
There is nothing for him to find. That was it. That went into rubble from there and never was built again.
Right.
They don't find it till the 20th century.
Right. So you still have to have the Exodus around 1450
yeah.
BCE.
Because if he's not there, then it don't happen.
Yeah.
How does he even know the place is there?
Yeah.
A big pile of rubble,
yeah.
And how the heck does he write about it? And he would have to be a total liar saying we watched it fall.
Right. Yeah, when I use the Torah for my timeline, the time that I came up with for the Exodus was plus or minus 10 or 15 years from 1450 BCE.
Yeah, and so did Brad. I mean, so he's pretty close to that. I can't give Brad an answer. I don't think you can either, as far as right down to the actual year, because it's
right.
And yet could have been a Yobel year, but I don't really think
yeah.
so.
Brad would love it to be, and I can see his rationale.
Fourteen sixty-eight
BCE would have been a Yobel year, and that makes perfect sense. And it might have been the case.
Yeah.
It's just that that we don't have the ability. I don't think we have the ability to place it on that date, other than to say, well, it makes sense from Yah's point of view. Like for 33 CE being the time of the fulfillment of Pesach Matzah and Bukurim, which is year 4000 Yah,
mm-hmm.
the evidence is so overwhelming. There's so much evidence affirming that date that, you know, I don't have any issue with that. And I don't have any issue with the 968 BCE for Dode laying the cornerstone of the temple, and therefore, you know, from that point of view, that is something as monumental from Yah's point of view as 2000 Yah and the establishment of the covenant on Mount Moriah with Abraham and Yishak that had to occur in 968 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get using the Torah within a few years of that time, and so it's just obvious. And then, of course, 2,000 years later, 40 Yobel, you've got 33 CE and the return, therefore, on Yom Kippurim, and 2033 CE, which is year 6,000 Yah. Those are easy. The timing of the Exodus freeing Yah's people from political and military and religious oppression, the year there. I just don't know enough. I tried to get it to narrow it down more than got to be really close to 1450, and that was the best I could do. And one of the challenges you have is then you can't just go to the Egyptian chronology and say, well, this would have been who?
About a bunch of Englishmen anyway.
You know, and they all just parrot.
They all have different motives.
They parrot one another, and they started off believing what they were reading ultimately in the hieroglyphics, as if ancient kings who pretended to be God didn't didn't exaggerate. So, you know, they didn't have a good filter. You know, that's one of the things you have to have. If you're going to study history or anything that's in today's news, you have to have a good filter. If you don't have a good filter, it's tough to do. David Rohl's A Test of Time is a wonderful book with lots of great information. It's one of
great pictures.
You know, maybe 500 or 1,000 that I have in my library that I have read. But if I wouldn't recommend it to most people, because you really have to have an effective filter.
They'll buy whatever you're selling.
Right.
See, just because he's a scholar doesn't make him a genius.
No. And the scholarly community, he's hated.
Right.
Yeah, he's hated in the scholarly community. He has no credibility in that community. So to call him a scholar is also a question mark. But he is he's active right now in trying to create a movie on the Exodus.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's pretty full of himself.
I've read his
writing, his book.
Humble on this. There's two things that lead off from this whole discussion,
mm-hmm.
and that we didn't really cover, and maybe one of them we can cover tonight. It takes a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing was, if we have a couple of minutes left, then was the motive to write it. The Egyptians have no motive, and Purah had no motive to mm-hmm. write this stuff down, and because basically what he said in all his reports was that his gods failed, Moshe's gods succeeded, we had to buy these people off to get them out of town.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, our king got wiped out by their god.
Right.
This ain't good stuff. You know, this won't fly in Mithraim.
Right.
The Amu, number one, are mostly illiterate. They don't care. They don't write the stuff down. They don't care about history. They don't care about anything lasting to begin with.
They don't even have a written language, the Muslims didn't have a written language. Right?
So their motive to write the things that we covered about the Hyksos doing this, and this, from the historian standpoint of all their stories, it makes... why did they report so many things? They didn't exonerate, and they didn't say, "Oh, look at the Israelites, how good they were." But they corroborated the evidence of what we had
yes.
read.
Yes.
The Israelites, why the heck do they want to do it? They kind of look up cowardly and stupid.
Right.
I mean, they do. You go out to the thing. God's done everything in the world for you. He's trying to be your father. He
yes.
says, "Go here, do that, and I've drowned everybody, and now go take the land." And they're so cowardly, they won't even go in.
Right. I know.
I mean, so that's why record it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the amazing things about the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is that the story of the Israelites is pathetic.
It is.
It makes you want
to... At one point, you catch on.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I had a guy that was critical of me. In fact, he called me every name under the book because I held the rabbis, the Jews in Yathrib, accountable for giving Muhammad the Talmud recitals that made it possible for him to create a Quran that had enough accuracy in it that it sounded plausible. And had they not done that, then there would be no Islam today. So without them selling Talmud recitals to Muhammad, there would be no Islam today. And so I held them accountable for doing that. That's not the sole reason that Islam exists, but had they not done so, Islam would not be a religion today. The Quran wouldn't exist. And you know, he just had a conniption fit about, well, then you're anti-Semitic. No. That would make Yahweh anti-Semitic because he's constantly holding Israelites accountable for the stupid things that they did that caused all of their heartache. And that is the story. The Israelites are a good, bad example.
Mm-hmm.
They did almost everything wrong.
Yeah.
And most of the time of the Israelites, with very few exceptions, the ratios that we see today are the ratios that existed then. It's one in a million.
Yeah.
Yahweh was content if one in a million knew him and chose to engage in a relationship with him. You know, the vast majority did not.
Yeah. Well, I can find no motive from them. I can find no motive from the Arabs, historians. Mm-hmm. I can't find it from the Israelites. I can't find it from the Hyksos records. I can't find the Egyptian records, and I certainly can't find it in the Torah. And I guarantee you, and if you're a better man than I, Gunga Din, if you can find a German, a Frenchman, or an English historian, or an Egyptologist who is not almost anti-Semitic to begin with, and they have no reason to promote the Torah, the Prophet,
correct,
and the Psalms. They're all, from a Christian standpoint to begin with, anti-Israel. So why would they give us all this information? They, obviously, they couldn't put it together.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they would say, oh, let's change it. And it's just lying all over there, and they just didn't know what to do with it because they have a different viewpoint and a different filter to begin with. So this stuff is not something that somebody twisted somehow to put it together. They just recorded the facts, and when you look at all the evidence there, you go, wow.
Yeah, it's all there. Right. It's all affirmed.
Right.
Yeah.